It had been a gift from Gran. Regardless, I snapped a picture of my room. There wasn't much else I could do tonight. It was too dark outside. And the feeling was growing stronger. It was almost a compulsion now. I would record everything about Forks before I had to leave it. Change was coming. I could feel it. It wasn't a pleasant prospect, not when life was perfect the way it was. I took my time coming back down the stairs, camera in hand, trying to ignore the butterflies in my stomach as I thought of the strange distance I didn't want to see in Edward's eyes. He would get over this. Probably he was worried that I would be upset when he asked me to leave. I would let him work through it without meddling, and I would be prepared when he asked. I had the camera ready as I leaned around the corner being sneaky. I was sure there was no chance that I had caught Edward by surprise, but he didn't look up. I felt a brief shiver as something icy twisted in my stomach. I ignored that and took the picture. They both looked at me then. Charlie frowned. Edward's face was empty, expressionless. "What are you doing, Bella?" Charlie complained. "Oh, come on," I pretended to smile as I went to sit on the floor in front of the sofa where Charlie lounged. "You know Mom will be calling soon to ask if I'm using my presents. I have to get to work before she can get her feelings hurt." "Why are you taking pictures of me, though?" he grumbled. "Because you're so handsome," I replied, keeping it light. "And because, since you bought the camera, you're obligated to be one of my subjects." He mumbled something unintelligible. "Hey, Edward," I said with admirable indifference. "Take one of me and my dad together." I threw the camera toward him, carefully avoiding his eyes, and knelt beside the arm of the sofa where Charlie's face was. Charlie sighed. "You need to smile, Bella," Edward murmured. I did my best, and the camera flashed. "Let me take one of you kids," Charlie suggested. I knew he was just trying to shift the camera's focus from himself. Edward stood and lightly tossed him the camera. I went to stand beside Edward, and the arrangement felt formal and strange to me. He put one hand lightly on my shoulder, and I wrapped my arm more securely around his waist. I wanted to look at his face, but I was afraid to. "Smile, Bella," Charlie reminded me again. I took a deep breath and smiled. The flash blinded me. "Enough pictures for tonight," Charlie said then, shoving the camera into a crevice of the sofa cushions and rolling over it. "You don't have to use the whole roll now." Edward dropped his hand from my shoulder and twisted casually out of my arm. He sat back down in the armchair. I hesitated and then went to sit against the sofa again. I was suddenly so frightened that my hands were shaking. I pressed them into my stomach to hide them, put my chin on my knees and stared at the TV screen in front of me, seeing nothing. When the show ended, I hadn't moved an inch. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Edward stand. "I'd better get home," he said. Charlie didn't look up from the commercial. "See ya." I got awkwardly to my feet. I was stiff from sitting so still, and followed Edward out the front door. He went straight to his car. "Will you stay?" I asked, no hope in my voice. I expected his answer, so it didn't hurt as much. "Not tonight." I didn't ask for a reason. He got in his car and drove away while I stood there, unmoving. I barely noticed that it was raining. I waited, without knowing what I waited for, until the door opened behind me. "Bella, what are you doing?" Charlie asked, surprised to see me standing there alone and dripping. "Nothing." I turned and trudged back to the house. It was a long night, with little in the way of rest. I got up as soon as there was a faint light outside my window. I dressed for school mechanically, waiting for the clouds to brighten. When I had eaten a bowl of cereal, I decided that it was light enough for pictures. I took one of my truck, and then the front of the house. I turned and snapped a few of the forest by Charlie's house. Funny how it didn't seem sinister like it used to. I realized I would miss this. The green, the timelessness, the mystery of the woods. All of it. I put the camera in my school bag before I left. I tried to concentrate on my new project, rather than the fact that Edward apparently hadn't gotten over things during the night. Along with the fear, I was beginning to feel impatience. How long could this last? It lasted through the morning. He walked silently beside me, never seeming to actually look at me. I tried to concentrate on my classes, but not even English could hold my attention. Mr. Birdie had to repeat his question about Lady Capulet twice before I realized he was talking to me. Edward whispered the correct answer under his breath, and then went back to ignoring me. At lunch, the silence continued. I felt like I was going to start screaming at any moment, so to distract myself, I leaned across the table's invisible line and spoke to Jessica. "Hey, Jess? What's up, Bella? Could you do me a favor?" I asked, reaching into my bag. "My mom wants me to get some pictures of my friends for a scrapbook, so take some pictures of everybody, okay?" I handed her the camera. "Sure," she said, grinning, and turned to snap a candid shot of Mike with his mouth full. A predictable picture war ensued. I watched them hand the camera around the table, giggling and flirting and complaining about being on film. It seemed strangely childish. Maybe I just wasn't in the mood for normal human behavior today. "Uh-oh," Jessica said apologetically as she returned the camera. "I think we used all your film." "That's okay. I think I already got pictures of everything else I needed." After school, Edward walked me back to the parking lot in silence. I had to work again, and for once I was glad. Time with me obviously wasn't helping things. Maybe time alone would be better. I dropped my film off at the Thriftway on my way to Newton's, and then picked up the developed pictures after work. At home, I said a brief hi to Charlie, grabbed a granola bar from the kitchen, and hurried up to my room with the envelope of photographs tucked under my arm. I sat in the middle of my bed and opened the envelope with wary curiosity. Ridiculously, I still half expected the first print to be a blank. When I pulled it out, I gasped aloud. Edward looked just as beautiful as he did in real life, staring at me out of the picture with the warm eyes I'd missed for the past few days. It was almost uncanny that anyone could look so beyond description. No thousand words could equal this picture. I flipped through the rest of the stack quickly once, then laid three of them out on the bed side by side. The first was the picture of Edward in the kitchen, his warm eyes touched with tolerant amusement. The second was Edward and Charlie watching ESPN. The difference in Edward's expression was severe. His eyes were careful here, reserved, still breathtakingly beautiful. But his face was colder, more like a sculpture, less alive. The last was the picture of Edward and me standing awkwardly side by side. Edward's face was the same as the last, cold and statue-like. But that wasn't the most troubling part of this photograph. The contrast between the two of us was painful. He looked like a god. I looked very average, even for a human, almost shamefully plain. I flipped the picture over with a feeling of disgust. Instead of doing my homework, I stayed up to put my pictures into the album. With a ballpoint pen, I scrawled captions under all the pictures, the names and the dates. I got to the picture of Edward and me, and without looking at it too long, I folded it in half and stuck it under the metal tab, Edward side up. When I was done, I stuffed the second set of prints in a fresh envelope and penned a long thank you letter to Renee. Edward still hadn't come over. I didn't want to admit that he was the reason I'd stayed up so late. But of course he was. I tried to remember the last time he'd stayed away like this, without an excuse, a phone call. He never had. Again, I didn't sleep well. School followed the silent, frustrating, terrifying pattern of the last 2 days. I felt relief when I saw Edward waiting for me in the parking lot, but it faded quickly. He was no different, unless maybe more remote. It was hard to even remember the reason for all this mess. My birthday already felt like the distant past. If only Alice would come back. Soon. Before this got any more out of hand. But I couldn't count on that. I decided that if I couldn't talk to him today, really talk, then I was going to see Carlisle tomorrow. I had to do something. After school, Edward and I were going to talk it out. I promised myself. I wasn't accepting any excuses. He walked me to my truck, and I steeled myself to make my demands. "Do you mind if I come over today?" he asked before we got to the truck, beating me to the punch. "Of course not." "Now?" he asked again, opening my door for me. "Sure." I kept my voice even, though I didn't like the urgency in his tone. "I was just going to drop a letter for Renee in the mailbox on the way. I'll meet you there." He looked at the fat envelope on the passenger seat. Suddenly he reached over me and snagged it. "I'll do it," he said quietly, "and I'll still beat you there." He smiled my favorite crooked smile. But it was wrong. It didn't reach his eyes. "Okay," I agreed, unable to smile back. He shut the door and headed toward his car. He did beat me home. He was parked in Charlie's spot when I pulled up in front of the house. That was a bad sign. He didn't plan to stay then. I shook my head and took a deep breath, trying to locate some courage. He got out of his car when I stepped out of the truck and came to meet me. He reached to take my book bag from me. That was normal. But he shoved it back onto the seat. That was not normal. "Come for a walk with me," he suggested in an unemotional voice, taking my hand. I didn't answer. I couldn't think of a way to protest, but I instantly knew that I wanted to. I didn't like this. "This is bad. This is very bad," the voice in my head repeated again and again. But he didn't wait for an answer. He pulled me along toward the east side of the yard, where the forest encroached. I followed unwillingly, trying to think through the panic. It was what I wanted, I reminded myself. The chance to talk it all through. So why was the panic choking me? We'd gone only a few steps into the trees when he stopped. We were barely on the trail. I could still see the house. Some walk. Edward leaned against a tree and stared at me, his expression unreadable. "Okay, let's talk," I said. It sounded braver than it felt. He took a deep breath. "Bella, we're leaving." I took a deep breath, too. This was an acceptable option. I thought I was prepared, but I still had to ask. "Why now? Another year?" "Bella, it's time. How much longer could we stay in Forks, after all? Carlisle can barely pass for 30, and he's claiming 33 now. We'd have to start over soon, regardless." His answer confused me. I thought the point of leaving was to let his family live in peace. Why did we have to leave if they were going? I stared at him, trying to understand what he meant. He stared back coldly. With a roll of nausea, I realized I'd misunderstood. "When you say we," I whispered, "I mean my family and myself." Each word separate and distinct. I shook my head back and forth mechanically, trying to clear it. He waited without any sign of impatience. It took a few minutes before I could speak. "Okay," I said, "I'll come with you." "You can't, Bella. Where we're going, it's not the right place for you. Where you are is the right place for me. I'm no good for you, Bella." "Don't be ridiculous." I wanted to sound angry, but it just sounded like I was begging. "You're the very best part of my life." "My world is not for you," he said grimly. "What happened with Jasper, that was nothing, Edward, nothing." "You're right," he agreed. "It was exactly what was to be expected." "You promised. In Phoenix, you promised that you would stay." As long as that was best for you, he interrupted to correct me.
No, this is about my soul, isn't it? I shouted furious, the words exploding out of me. Somehow it still sounded like a plea. Carlyle told me about that, and I don't care, Edward. I don't care. You can have my soul. I don't want it without you. It's yours already.
He took a deep breath and stared, unseeingly, at the ground for a long moment. His mouth twisted the tiniest bit. When he finally looked up, his eyes were different, harder, like the liquid gold had frozen solid. Bella, I don't want you to come with me. He spoke the words slowly and precisely, his cold eyes on my face, watching as I absorbed what he was really saying. There was a pause as I repeated the words in my head a few times, sifting through them for their real intent. You don't want me? I tried out the words, confused by the way they sounded, placed in that order. No. I stared, uncomprehending into his eyes. He stared back without apology. His eyes were like topaz, hard and clear and very deep. I felt like I could see into them for miles and miles, yet nowhere in their bottomless depths could I see a contradiction to the word he'd spoken. Well, that changes things. I was surprised by how calm and reasonable my voice sounded. It must be because I was so numb. I couldn't realize what he was telling me. It still didn't make any sense. He looked away into the trees as he spoke again. Of course, I'll always love you, in a way. But what happened the other night made me realize that it's time for a change. Because I'm tired of pretending to be something I'm not, Bella. I am not human. He looked back, and the icy planes of his perfect face were not human. I've let this go on much too long. And I'm sorry for that. Don't. My voice was just a whisper now. Awareness was beginning to seep through me, trickling like acid through my veins. Don't do this. He just stared at me, and I could see from his eyes that my words were far too late. He already had. You're not good for me, Bella. He turned his earlier words around, and so I had no argument. How well I knew that I wasn't good enough for him. I opened my mouth to say something, and then closed it again. He waited patiently, his face wiped clean of all emotion. I tried again. If that's what you want, he nodded once. My whole body went numb. I couldn't feel anything below the neck. I would like to ask one favor, though, if that's not too much, he said. I wonder what he saw in my face, because something flickered across his own face in response. But before I could identify it, he'd composed his features into the same serene mask. Anything, I vowed, my voice faintly stronger. As I watched, his frozen eyes melted. The gold became liquid again, molten, burning down into mine with an intensity that was overwhelming. Don't do anything reckless or stupid, he ordered, no longer detached. Do you understand what I'm saying? I nodded helplessly. His eyes cooled, the distance returned. I'm thinking of Charlie, of course. He needs you. Take care of yourself for him. I nodded again. I will, I whispered. He seemed to relax just a little. And I'll make you a promise in return, he said. I promise that this will be the last time you'll see me. I won't come back. I won't put you through anything like this again. You can go on with your life without any more interference from me. It will be as if I'd never existed. My knees must have started to shake because the trees were suddenly wobbling. I could hear the blood pounding faster than normal behind my ears. His voice sounded farther away. He smiled gently. Don't worry. You're human. Your memory is no more than a sieve. Time heals all wounds for your kind.
And your memories?
I asked. It sounded like there was something stuck in my throat, like I was choking.
Well,
he hesitated for a short second. I won't forget. But my kind, we're very easily distracted. He smiled. The smile was tranquil, and it did not touch his eyes. He took a step away from me. That's everything, I suppose. We won't bother you again. The plural caught my attention. That surprised me. I would have thought I was beyond noticing anything.
Alice isn't coming back, I realized.
I don't know how he heard me. The words made no sound, but he seemed to understand. He shook his head slowly, always watching my face. No, they're all gone. I stayed behind to tell you goodbye.
Alice is gone?
My voice was blank with disbelief. She wanted to say goodbye, but I convinced her that a clean break would be better for you. I was dizzy. It was hard to concentrate. His words swirled around in my head. And I heard the doctor at the hospital in Phoenix last spring as he showed me the x-rays. You can see it's a clean break. His finger traced along the picture of my severed bone. That's good. It will heal more easily, more quickly. I tried to breathe normally. I needed to concentrate, to find a way out of this nightmare. Goodbye, Bella, he said in the same quiet, peaceful voice.
Wait!
I choked out the word, reaching for him, willing my deadened legs to carry me forward. I thought he was reaching for me too, but his cold hands locked around my wrists and pinned them to my sides. He leaned down and pressed his lips very lightly to my forehead for the briefest instant. My eyes closed. Take care of yourself, he breathed, cool against my skin. There was a light, unnatural breeze. My eyes flashed open. The leaves on a small vine maple shuddered with the gentle wind of his passage. He was gone. With shaky legs, ignoring the fact that my action was useless, I followed him into the forest. The evidence of his path had disappeared instantly. There were no footprints. The leaves were still again, but I walked forward without thinking. I could not do anything else. I had to keep moving. If I stopped looking for him, it was over. Love, life, meaning, over. I walked and walked. Time made no sense as I pushed slowly through the thick undergrowth. It was hours passing, but also only seconds. Maybe it felt like time had frozen because the forest looked the same, no matter how far I went. I started to worry that I was traveling in a circle, a very small circle at that, but I kept going. I stumbled often, and as it grew darker and darker, I fell often too. Finally, I tripped over something. It was black now, I had no idea what caught my foot, and I stayed down. I rolled onto my side so that I could breathe, and curled up on the wet bracken. As I lay there, I had a feeling that more time was passing than I realized. I couldn't remember how long it had been since nightfall. Was it always so dark here at night? Surely, as a rule, some little bit of moonlight would filter down through the clouds, through the chinks in the canopy of trees, and find the ground. Not tonight. Tonight the sky was utterly black. Perhaps there was no moon tonight. A lunar eclipse. A new moon. A new moon. I shivered, though I wasn't cold. It was black for a long time before I heard them calling. Someone was shouting my name. It was muted, muffled by the wet growth that surrounded me, but it was definitely my name. I didn't recognize the voice. I thought about answering, but I was dazed. And it took a long time to come to the conclusion that I should answer. By then, the calling had stopped. Sometime later, the rain woke me up. I don't think I'd really fallen asleep. I was just lost in an unthinking stupor, holding with all my strength to the numbness that kept me from realizing what I didn't want to know. The rain bothered me a little. It was cold. I unwrapped my arms from around my legs to cover my face. It was then that I heard the calling again. It was farther away this time, and sometimes it sounded like several voices were calling at once. I tried to breathe deeply. I remembered that I should answer, but I didn't think they would be able to hear me. Would I be able to shout loud enough? Suddenly, there was another sound, startlingly close, a kind of snuffling, an animal sound. It sounded big. I wondered if I should feel afraid. I didn't, just numb. It didn't matter. The snuffling went away. The rain continued, and I could feel the water pooling up against my cheek. I was trying to gather the strength to turn my head when I saw the light. At first, it was just a dim glow reflecting off the bushes in the distance. It grew brighter and brighter, illuminating a large space unlike the focused beam of a flashlight. The light broke through the closest brush, and I could see that it was a propane lantern. But that was all I could see. The brightness blinded me for a moment. Bella. The voice was deep and unfamiliar, but full of recognition. He wasn't calling my name to search. He was acknowledging that I was found. I stared up, impossibly high, it seemed, at the dark face that I could now see above me. I was vaguely aware that the stranger probably only looked so tall because my head was still on the ground. "Have you been hurt?" I knew the words meant something, but I could only stare, bewildered. How could the meeting matter at this point? "Bella, my name is Sam Yuli." There was nothing familiar about his name. "Charlie sent me to look for you." "Charlie?" That struck a chord, and I tried to pay more attention to what he was saying. Charlie mattered, if nothing else did. The tall man held out a hand. I gazed at it, not sure what I was supposed to do. His black eyes appraised me for a second, and then he shrugged. In a quick and supple motion, he pulled me up from the ground and into his arms. I hung there limp, as he loped swiftly through the wet forest. Some part of me knew this should upset me, being carried away by a stranger, but there was nothing left in me to upset. It didn't seem like too much time passed before there were lights and the deep babble of many male voices. Sam Yuli slowed as he approached the commotion. "I've got her," he called in a booming voice. The babble ceased, and then picked up again with more intensity. A confusing swirl of faces moved over me. Sam's voice was the only one that made sense in the chaos, perhaps because my ear was against his chest. "No, I don't think she's hurt," he told someone. "She just keeps saying, 'He's gone.'" Was I saying that out loud? I bit down on my lip. "Bella, honey, are you all right?" That was one voice I would know anywhere, even distorted as it was now with worry. "Charlie?" My voice sounded strange and small. "I'm right here, baby." There was a shifting under me, followed by the leathery smell of my dad's sheriff jacket. Charlie staggered under my weight. "Maybe I should hold on to her," Sam Yuli suggested. "I've got her," Charlie said, a little breathless. He walked slowly, struggling. I wished I could tell him to put me down and let me walk, but I couldn't find my voice. There were lights everywhere, held by the crowd walking with him. It felt like a parade, or a funeral procession. I closed my eyes. "We're almost home now, honey," Charlie mumbled now and then. I opened my eyes again when I heard the door unlock. We were on the porch of our house, and the tall, dark man named Sam was holding the door for Charlie, one arm extended toward us, as if he was preparing to catch me when Charlie's arms failed. But Charlie managed to get me through the door into the couch in the living room. "Dad, I'm all wet," I objected feebly. That doesn't matter. His voice was gruff. And then he was talking to someone else. Blankets are in the cupboard at the top of the stairs.
Bella?
A new voice asked. I looked at the gray-haired man leaning over me, and recognition came after a few slow seconds.
Dr. Durandy?
I mumbled.
That's right, dear, he said. Are you hurt, Bella?
It took me a minute to think that through. I was confused by the memory of Sam Yulee's similar question in the woods. Only Sam had asked something else. Have you been hurt? He'd said. The difference seemed significant somehow. Dr. Durandy was waiting. One grizzled eyebrow rose, and the wrinkles on his forehead deepened.
I'm not hurt, I lied.
The words were true enough for what he'd asked. His warm hand touched my forehead, and his fingers pressed against the inside of my wrist. I watched his lips as he counted to himself, his eyes on his watch.
What happened to you? He asked casually.
I froze under his hand, tasting panic in the back of my throat.
Did you get lost in the woods?
He prodded. I was aware of several other people listening. Three tall men with dark faces from La Push, the Quileute Indian reservation down on the coastline, I guessed Sam Yulee among them, were standing very close together and staring at me. Mr. Newton was there with Mike and Mr. Weber, Angela's father. They were all watching me more surreptitiously than the strangers. Other deep voices rumbled from the kitchen and outside the front door. Half the town must have been looking for me. Charlie was the closest. He leaned in to hear my answer.
Yes, I whispered. I got lost.
The doctor nodded, thoughtful, his fingers probing gently against the glands under my jaw. Charlie's face hardened.
Do you feel tired? Dr. Durandy asked.
I nodded and closed my eyes obediently.
I don't think there's anything wrong with her, I heard the doctor mutter to Charlie after a moment. Just exhaustion. Let her sleep it off and I'll come check on her tomorrow.
He paused. He must have looked at his watch because he added,
Well, later today, actually.
There was a creaking sound as they both pushed off from the couch to get to their feet.
Is it true?
Charlie whispered. Their voices were farther away now. I strained to hear.
Did they leave?
Dr. Cullen asked us not to say anything, Dr. Durandy answered. The offer was very sudden. They had to choose immediately.
Carlyle didn't want to make a big production out of leaving.
A little warning might have been nice, Charlie grumbled. Dr. Durandy sounded uncomfortable when he replied.
Yes, well, in this situation some warning might have been called for.
I didn't want to listen anymore. I felt around for the edge of the quilt someone had laid on top of me and pulled it over my ear. I drifted in and out of alertness. I heard Charlie whisper thanks to the volunteers as one by one they left. I felt his fingers on my forehead, and then the weight of another blanket. The phone rang a few times, and he hurried to catch it before it could wake me. He muttered reassurances in a low voice to the callers.
Yeah, we found her. She's okay. She got lost. She's fine now, he said again and again.
I heard the springs in the armchair groan when he settled himself in for the night. A few minutes later, the phone rang again. Charlie moaned as he struggled to his feet, and then he rushed, stumbling, to the kitchen. I pulled my head deeper under the blankets, not wanting to listen to the same conversation again.
Yeah,
Charlie said and yawned. His voice changed. It was much more alert when he spoke again.
Where?
There was a pause.
You're sure it's outside the reservation?
Another short pause.
But what could be burning out there?
He sounded both worried and mystified.
Look, I'll call down there and check it out.
I listened with more interest as he punched in a number.
Hey, Billy, it's Charlie. Sorry I'm calling so early. No, she's fine. She's sleeping. Thanks, but that's not why I called. I just got a call from Mrs. Stanley, and she says that from her second-story window she can see fires out on the sea cliffs. But I didn't really... Oh. Suddenly there was an edge in his voice. Irritation or anger. And why are they doing that? Uh-huh. Really? He said it sarcastically. Well, don't apologize to me.
Yeah, just make sure the flames don't spread.
I know.
I'm surprised they got them lit at all in this weather.
Charlie hesitated and then added grudgingly, Thanks for sending Sam and the other boys up. You were right. They do know the forest better than we do. It was Sam who found her, so I owe you one. Yeah, I'll talk to you later, he agreed, still sour, before hanging up. Charlie muttered something incoherent as he shuffled back to the living room. What's wrong? I asked. He hurried to my side. I'm sorry I woke you, honey. Is something burning? It's nothing, he assured me. Just some bonfires out on the cliffs. Bonfires? I asked. My voice didn't sound curious. It sounded dead. Charlie frowned. Some of the kids from the reservation being rowdy, he explained. Why? I wondered dully. I could tell he didn't want to answer. He looked at the floor under his knees. They're celebrating the news. His tone was bitter. There was only one piece of news I could think of, try as I might not to. And then the pieces snapped together. Because the Cullens left, I whispered. They don't like the Cullens in La Push. I'd forgotten about that. The Quileutes had their superstitions about the Cold Ones, the blood drinkers that were enemies to their tribe, just like they had their legends of the Great Flood and Wolfmen ancestors. Just stories, folklore to most of them. Then there were the few that believed. Charlie's good friend, Billy Black, believed. Though even Jacob, his own son, thought he was full of stupid superstitions. Billy had warned me to stay away from the Cullens. The name stirred something inside me, something that began to claw its way toward the surface, something I knew I didn't want to face. It's ridiculous, Charlie spluttered. We sat in silence for a moment. The sky was no longer black outside the window. Somewhere behind the rain, the sun was beginning to rise. Bella? Charlie asked. I looked at him uneasily. He left you alone in the woods, Charlie guessed. I deflected his question. How did you know where to find me? My mind shied away from the inevitable awareness that was coming quickly now. Your note, Charlie answered, surprised. He reached into the back pocket of his jeans and pulled out a much abused piece of paper. It was dirty and damp, with multiple creases from being opened and refolded many times. He unfolded it again and held it up as evidence. The messy handwriting was remarkably close to my own. Going for a walk with Edward up the path, it said. Back soon, B. When you didn't come back, I called the Cullens, and no one answered, Charlie said in a low voice. Then I called the hospital, and Dr. Durandy told me that Carlisle was gone. Where did they go? I mumbled. He stared at me. Didn't Edward tell you? I shook my head, recoiling. The sound of his name unleashed the thing that was clawing inside of me, a pain that knocked me breathless, astonished me with its force. Charlie eyed me doubtfully as he answered. Carlisle took a job with a big hospital in Los Angeles. I guess they threw a lot of money at him. Sunny L.A. The last place they would really go. I remembered my nightmare with the mirror, the bright sunlight shimmering off of his skin. Agony ripped through me with the memory of his face. I want to know if Edward left you alone out there in the middle of the woods, Charlie insisted. His name sent another wave of torture through me. I shook my head, frantic, desperate to escape the pain. It was my fault. He left me right here on the trail in sight of the house, but I tried to follow him. Charlie started to say something. Childishly, I covered my ears. I can't talk about this anymore, Dad. I want to go to my room.
Before he could answer, I scrambled up from the couch and lurched my way up the stairs. Someone had been in the house to leave a note for Charlie, a note that would lead him to find me. From the minute that I'd realized this, a horrible suspicion began to grow in my head. I rushed to my room, shutting and locking the door behind me, before I ran to the CD player by my bed. Everything looked exactly the same as I'd left it. I pressed down on the top of the CD player. The latch unhooked, and the lid slowly swung open. It was empty. The album Renee had given me sat on the floor beside the bed, just where I'd put it last. I lifted the cover with a shaking hand. I didn't have to flip any farther than the first page. The little metal corners no longer held a picture in place. The page was blank except for my own handwriting scrawled across the bottom. Edward Cullen, Charlie's Kitchen, September 13th. I stopped there. I was sure that he would have been very thorough. "It will be as if I'd never existed," he'd promised me. I felt the smooth wooden floor beneath my knees, and then the palms of my hands, and then it was pressed against the skin of my cheek. I hoped that I was fainting, but to my disappointment, I didn't lose consciousness. The waves of pain that had only lapped at me before now reared high up and washed over my head, pulling me under. I did not resurface. October. November. December. January. Chapter 4. Waking up. Time passes. Even when it seems impossible. Even when each tick of the second hand aches like the pulse of blood behind a bruise. It passes unevenly, in strange lurches and dragging lulls. But pass it does. Even for me. Charlie's fist came down on the table. "That's it. Bella, I'm sending you home." I looked up from my cereal, which I was pondering rather than eating, and stared at Charlie in shock. I hadn't been following the conversation. Actually, I hadn't been aware that we were having a conversation, and I wasn't sure what he meant. "I am home," I mumbled, confused. "I'm sending you to Renee, to Jacksonville," he clarified. Charlie watched with exasperation as I slowly grasped the meaning of his words. What did I do? I felt my face crumple. It was so unfair. My behavior had been above reproach for the past 4 months. After that first week, which neither of us ever mentioned, I hadn't missed a day of school or work. My grades were perfect. I never broke curfew. I never went anywhere from which to break curfew in the first place. I only very rarely served leftovers. Charlie was scowling. You didn't do anything. That's the problem. You never do anything. You want me to get into trouble? I wondered, my eyebrows pulling together in mystification. I made an effort to pay attention. It wasn't easy. I was so used to tuning everything out, my ears felt stopped up. Trouble would be better than this. This moping around all the time. That stung a bit. I'd been careful to avoid all forms of moroseness, moping included. I am not moping around. Wrong word, he grudgingly conceded. Moping would be better. That would be doing something. You're just lifeless, Bella. I think that's the word I want. This accusation struck home. I sighed and tried to put some animation into my response. I'm sorry, Dad. My apology sounded a little flat, even to me. I thought I'd been fooling him. Keeping Charlie from suffering was the whole point of all this effort. How depressing to think that the effort had been wasted. I don't want you to apologize. I sighed. Then tell me what you do want me to do. Bella, he hesitated. scrutinizing my reaction to his next words. Honey, you're not the first person to go through this kind of thing, you know.
I know that.
My accompanying grimace was limp and unimpressive.
Listen, honey, I think that maybe you need some help.
Help? He paused, searching for the words again. When your mother left, he began, frowning, and took you with her, he inhaled deeply. Well, that was a really bad time for me.
I know, Dad, I mumbled.
But I handled it, he pointed out. Honey, you're not handling it. I waited. I hoped it would get better. He stared at me and I looked down quickly. I think we both know it's not getting better.
I'm fine, he ignored me.
Maybe if you talk to someone about it, a professional.
You want me to see a shrink?
My voice was a shade sharper as I realized what he was getting at.
Maybe it would help.
And maybe it wouldn't help one little bit.
I didn't know much about psychoanalysis, but I was pretty sure that it didn't work unless the subject was relatively honest.
Sure, I could tell the truth, if I wanted to spend the rest of my life in a padded cell.
He examined my obstinate expression and switched to another line of attack.
It's beyond me, Bella.
Maybe your mother.
Look, I said in a flat voice. I'll go out tonight, if you want. I'll call Jess or Angela.
That's not what I want, he argued, frustrated. I don't think I can live through seeing you try harder. I've never seen anyone trying so hard. It hurts to watch.
I pretended to be dense, looking down at the table.
I don't understand, Dad. First you're mad because I'm not doing anything, and then you say you don't want me to go out.
I want you to be happy.
No, not even that much. I just want you not to be miserable. I think you'll have a better chance if you get out of Forks.
My eyes flashed up with the first small spark of feeling I'd had in too long to contemplate.
I'm not leaving, I said.
Why not? He demanded.
I'm in my last semester of school. It would screw everything up.
You're a good student. You'll figure it out.
I don't want to crowd Mom and Phil.
Your mother's been dying to have you back.
Florida is too hot.
His fist came down on the table again.
We both know what's really going on here, Bella. And it's not good for you.
He took a deep breath.
It's been months. No calls, no letters, no contact. You can't keep waiting for him.
I glowered at him. The heat almost, but not quite, reached my face. It had been a long time since I'd blushed with any emotion. This whole subject was utterly forbidden, as he was well aware.
I'm not waiting for anything.
I don't expect anything, I said in a low monotone.
Bella, Charlie began, his voice thick.
I have to get to school, I interrupted, standing up and yanking my untouched breakfast from the table. I dumped my bowl in the sink without pausing to wash it out. I couldn't deal with any more conversation.
I'll make plans with Jessica, I called over my shoulder as I strapped on my school bag, not meeting his eyes.
Maybe I won't be home for dinner. We'll go to Port Angeles and watch a movie.
I was out the front door before he could react. In my haste to get away from Charlie, I ended up being one of the first ones to school. The plus side was that I got a really good parking spot. The downside was that I had free time on my hands, and I tried to avoid free time at all costs. Quickly, before I could start thinking about Charlie's accusations, I pulled out my calculus book. I flipped it open to the section we should be starting today and tried to make sense of it. Reading math was even worse than listening to it, but I was getting better at it. In the last several months, I'd spent 10 times the amount of time on calculus than I'd ever spent on math before. As a result, I was managing to keep in the range of a low A. I knew Mr. Varner felt my improvement was all due to his superior teaching methods. And if that made him happy, I wasn't going to burst his bubble. I forced myself to keep at it until the parking lot was full,
and I ended up rushing to English. We were working on Animal Farm, an easy subject matter. I didn't mind communism. It was a welcome change from the exhausting romances that made up most of the curriculum. I settled into my seat, pleased by the distraction of Mr. Birdie's lecture. Time moved easily while I was in school. The bell rang all too soon. I started repacking my bag.
Bella?
I recognized Mike's voice, and I knew what his next words would be before he said them.
Are you working tomorrow?
I looked up. He was leaning across the aisle with an anxious expression. Every Friday he asked me the same question. Never mind that I hadn't taken so much as a sick day. Well, with one exception, months ago. But he had no reason to look at me with such concern. I was a model employee. Tomorrow is Saturday, isn't it? I said, having just had it pointed out to me by Charlie. I realized how lifeless my voice really sounded.
Yeah, it is, he agreed. See you in Spanish.
He waved once before turning his back. He didn't bother walking me to class anymore. I trudged off to calculus with a grim expression. This was the class where I sat next to Jessica. It had been weeks, maybe months, since Jess had even greeted me when I passed her in the hall. I knew I had offended her with my antisocial behavior, and she was sulking. It wasn't going to be easy to talk to her now, especially to ask her to do me a favor. I weighed my options carefully as I loitered outside the classroom, procrastinating. I wasn't about to face Charlie again without some kind of social interaction to report. I knew I couldn't lie, though the thought of driving to Port Angeles and back alone, being sure my odometer reflected the correct mileage just in case he checked, was very tempting. Jessica's mom was the biggest gossip in town, and Charlie was bound to run into Mrs. Stanley sooner rather than later. When he did, he would no doubt mention the trip. Lying was out. With a sigh, I shoved the door open. Mr. Varner gave me a dark look. He'd already started the lecture. I hurried to my seat. Jessica didn't look up as I sat next to her. I was glad that I had 50 minutes to mentally prepare myself. This class flew by even faster than English. A small part of that speed was due to my goody-goody preparation this morning in the truck. But mostly it stemmed from the fact that time always sped up when I was looking forward to something unpleasant. I grimaced when Mr. Varner dismissed the class 5 minutes early. He smiled like he was being nice. Jess? My nose wrinkled as I cringed, waiting for her to turn on me. She twisted in her seat to face me, eyeing me incredulously.
Are you talking to me, Bella?
Of course. I widened my eyes to suggest innocence.
What? Do you need help with calculus?
Her tone was a tad sour.
No, I shook my head. Actually, I wanted to know if you would go to the movies with me tonight. I really need a girl's night out.
The words sounded stiff, like badly delivered lines, and she looked suspicious.
Why are you asking me? She asked, still unfriendly.
You're the first person I think of when I want girl time. I smiled, and I hoped the smile looked genuine. It was probably true. She was at least the first person I thought of when I wanted to avoid Charlie. It amounted to the same thing. She seemed a little mollified.
Well, I don't know.
Do you have plans?
No. I guess I can go with you.
But what do you want to see? I'm not sure what's playing, I hedged. This was the tricky part. I racked my brain for a clue. Hadn't I heard someone talk about a movie recently? Seen a poster? How about that one with the female president? She looked at me oddly. Bella, that one's been out of the theater forever.
Oh, I frowned. Is there anything you'd like to see?
Jessica's natural bubbliness started to leak out in spite of herself as she thought out loud.
Well, there's that new romantic comedy that's getting great reviews. I want to see that one. And my dad just saw Dead End, and he really liked it.
I grasped at the promising title. What's that one about?
Zombies or something, He said it was the scariest thing he'd seen in years. That sounds perfect. I'd rather deal with real zombies than watch a romance. Okay. She seemed surprised by my response. I tried to remember if I liked scary movies, but I wasn't sure. Do you want me to pick you up after school? She offered. Sure. Jessica smiled at me with tentative friendliness before she left. My answering smile was just a little late, but I thought that she saw it. The rest of the day passed quickly. My thoughts focused on planning for tonight. I knew from experience that once I got Jessica talking, I would be able to get away with a few mumbled responses at the appropriate moments. Only minimal interaction would be required. The thick haze that blurred my days now was sometimes confusing. I was surprised when I found myself in my room, not clearly remembering the drive home from school or even opening the front door. But that didn't matter. Losing track of time was the most I asked from life. I didn't fight the haze as I turned to my closet. The numbness was more essential in some places than in others. I barely registered what I was looking at as I slid the door aside to reveal the pile of rubbish on the left side of my closet, under the clothes I never wore. My eyes did not stray toward the black garbage bag that held my present from that last birthday. Did not see the shape of the stereo where it strained against the black plastic. I didn't think of the bloody mess my nails had been when I'd finished clawing it out of the dashboard. I yanked the old purse I rarely used off the nail it hung from and shoved the door shut. Just then I heard a horn honking. I swiftly traded my wallet from my school bag into the purse. I was in a hurry, as if rushing would somehow make the night pass more quickly. I glanced at myself in the hall mirror before I opened the door, arranging my features carefully into a smile and trying to hold them there. "Thanks for coming with me tonight," I told Jess as I climbed into the passenger seat, trying to infuse my tone with gratitude. It had been a while since I'd really thought about what I was saying to anyone besides Charlie. Jess was harder. I wasn't sure which were the right emotions to fake. "Sure. So, what brought this on?" Jess wondered as she drove down my street. "Brought what on? Why did you suddenly decide to go out?" It sounded like she changed her question halfway through. I shrugged. Just needed a change. I recognized the song on the radio then and quickly reached for the dial. "Do you mind?" I asked. "No, go ahead." I scanned through the stations until I found one that was harmless. I peeked at Jess's expression as the new music filled the car. Her eyes squinted. "Since when do you listen to rap?" "I don't know," I said. "A while." "You like this?" she asked doubtfully. "Sure." It would be much too hard to interact with Jessica normally if I had to work to tune out the music, too. I nodded my head, hoping I was in time with the beat. "Okay." She stared out the windshield with wide eyes. "So, what's up with you and Mike these days?" I asked quickly. "You see him more than I do." The question hadn't started her talking like I'd hoped it would. "It's hard to talk at work," I mumbled, and then I tried again. "Have you been out with anyone lately?" "Not really. I go out with Connor sometimes. I went out with Eric 2 weeks ago." She rolled her eyes, and I sensed a long story. I clutched at the opportunity. "Eric Yorkie? Who asked who?" She groaned, getting more animated. "He did, of course." I couldn't think of a nice way to say no. "Where did he take you?" I demanded, knowing she would interpret my eagerness as interest. "Tell me all about it." She launched into her tale, and I settled into my seat more comfortable now. I paid strict attention, murmuring in sympathy and gasping in horror as called for. When she was finished with her Eric story, she continued into a Connor comparison without any prodding. The movie was playing early, so Jess thought we should hit the twilight showing and eat later. I was happy to go along with whatever she wanted. After all, I was getting what I wanted, Charlie off my back. I kept Jess talking through the previews so I could ignore them more easily. But I got nervous when the movie started.
A young couple was walking along a beach, swinging hands and discussing their mutual affection with gooey falseness. I resisted the urge to cover my ears and start humming. I had not bargained for a romance. "I thought we picked the zombie movie," I hissed to Jessica. "This is the zombie movie." "Then why isn't anyone getting eaten?" I asked desperately. She looked at me with wide eyes that were almost alarmed. "I'm sure that part's coming," she whispered. "I'm getting popcorn. Do you want any?"
"No, thanks."
Someone shushed us from behind. I took my time at the concession counter, watching the clock and debating what percentage of a 90-minute movie could be spent on romantic exposition. I decided 10 minutes was more than enough, but I paused just inside the theater doors to be sure. I could hear horrified screams blaring from the speakers, so I knew I'd waited long enough.
"You missed everything," Jess murmured when I slid back into my seat. "Almost everyone is a zombie now."
"Long line." I offered her some popcorn. She took a handful. The rest of the movie was comprised of gruesome zombie attacks and endless screaming from the handful of people left alive, their numbers dwindling quickly. I would have thought there was nothing in that to disturb me, but I felt uneasy, and I wasn't sure why at first. It wasn't until almost the very end, as I watched a haggard zombie shambling after the last shrieking survivor, that I realized what the problem was. The scene kept cutting between the horrified face of the heroine and the dead, emotionless face of her pursuer, back and forth as it closed the distance. And I realized which one resembled me the most. I stood up.
"Where are you going? There's like 2 minutes left," Jess hissed.
"I need a drink," I muttered as I raced for the exit. I sat down on the bench outside the theater door and tried very hard not to think of the irony. But it was ironic, all things considered, that in the end I would wind up as a zombie. I hadn't seen that one coming. Not that I hadn't dreamed of becoming a mythical monster once, just never a grotesque animated corpse. I shook my head to dislodge that train of thought, feeling panicky. I couldn't afford to think about what I'd once dreamed of. It was depressing to realize that I wasn't the heroine anymore, that my story was over. Jessica came out of the theater doors and hesitated, probably wondering where the best place was to search for me. When she saw me, she looked relieved, but only for a moment. Then she looked irritated. "Was the movie too scary for you?" she wondered.
"Yeah," I agreed. "I guess I'm just a coward."
"That's funny," she frowned. "I didn't think you were scared. I was screaming all the time, but I didn't hear you scream once. So I didn't know why you left." I shrugged. "Just scared." She relaxed a little. "That was the scariest movie I think I've ever seen. I'll bet we're going to have nightmares tonight."
"No doubt about that," I said, trying to keep my voice normal.
It was inevitable that I would have nightmares, but they wouldn't be about zombies. Her eyes flashed to my face and away. Maybe I hadn't succeeded with the normal voice.
"Where do you want to eat?" Jess asked.
"I don't care."
"Okay."
Jess started talking about the male lead in the movie as we walked. I nodded as she gushed over his hotness, unable to remember seeing a non-zombie man at all. I didn't watch where Jessica was leading me. I was only vaguely aware that it was dark and quieter now. It took me longer than it should have to realize why it was quiet. Jessica had stopped babbling. I looked at her apologetically, hoping I hadn't hurt her feelings. Jessica wasn't looking at me. Her face was tense. She stared straight ahead and walked fast. As I watched, her eyes darted quickly to the right, across the road, and back again. I glanced around myself for the first time. We were on a short stretch of unlit sidewalk. The little shops lining the street were all locked up for the night, windows black. Half a block ahead, the streetlights started up again, and I could see, farther down, the bright golden arches of the McDonald's she was heading for. Across the street, there was one open business. The windows were covered from inside, and there were neon signs, advertisements for different brands of beer, glowing in front of them. The biggest sign, in brilliant green, was the name of the bar, One-Eyed Pete's. I wondered if there were some pirate theme not visible from outside. The metal door was propped open. It was dimly lit inside, and the low murmur of many voices and the sound of ice clinking and glasses floated across the street. Lounging against the wall beside the door were four men. I glanced back at Jessica. Her eyes were fixed on the path ahead, and she moved briskly. She didn't look frightened, just wary, trying to not attract attention to herself. I paused without thinking, looking back at the four men with a strong sense of déjà vu. This was a different road, a different night, but the scene was so much the same. One of them was even short and dark. As I stopped and turned toward them, that one looked up in interest. I stared back at him, frozen on the sidewalk.
Bella?
Jess whispered.
What are you doing?
I shook my head, not sure myself.
I think I know them, I muttered.
What was I doing? I should be running from this memory as fast as I could, blocking the image of the four lounging men from my mind, protecting myself with the numbness I couldn't function without. Why was I stepping dazed into the street? It seemed too coincidental that I should be in Port Angeles with Jessica, on a dark street even. My eyes focused on the short one, trying to match the features to my memory of the man who had threatened me that night almost a year ago. I wondered if there was any way I would recognize the man, if it was really him. That particular part of that particular evening was just a blur. My body remembered it better than my mind did. The tension in my legs as I tried to decide whether to run or to stand my ground. The dryness in my throat as I struggled to build a decent scream. The tight stretch of skin across my knuckles as I clenched my hands into fists. The chills on the back of my neck when the dark-haired man called me sugar. There was an indefinite, implied kind of menace to these men that had nothing to do with that other night. It sprung from the fact that they were strangers, and it was dark here, and they outnumbered us. Nothing more specific than that. But it was enough that Jessica's voice cracked in panic as she called after me.
Bella, come on!
I ignored her, walking slowly forward without ever making the conscious decision to move my feet. I didn't understand why, but the nebulous threat the men presented drew me toward them. It was a senseless impulse, but I hadn't felt any kind of impulse in so long. I followed it. Something unfamiliar beat through my veins. Adrenaline, I realized, long absent from my system, drumming my pulse faster and fighting against the lack of sensation. It was strange. Why the adrenaline when there was no fear? It was almost as if it were an echo of the last time I'd stood like this, on a dark street in Port Angeles with strangers. I saw no reason for fear. I couldn't imagine anything in the world that there was left to be afraid of, not physically at least. One of the few advantages of losing everything. I was halfway across the street when Jess caught up to me and grabbed my arm.
Bella, you can't go in a bar, she hissed.
I'm not going in, I said absently, shaking her hand off. I just want to see something.
Are you crazy? She whispered. Are you suicidal?
That question caught my attention, and my eyes focused on her. No, I'm not. My voice sounded defensive, but it was true. I wasn't suicidal. Even in the beginning, when death unquestionably would have been a relief, I didn't consider it. I owed too much to Charlie. I felt too responsible for Renee. I had to think of them. And I'd made a promise not to do anything stupid or reckless. For all those reasons, I was still breathing. Remembering that promise, I felt a twinge of guilt. But what I was doing right now didn't really count. It wasn't like I was taking a blade to my wrists. Jess's eyes were round, her mouth hung open. Her question about suicide had been rhetorical, I realized too late. Go eat, I encouraged her, waving toward the fast food. I didn't like the way she looked at me. I'll catch up in a minute. I turned away from her, back to the men who were watching us with amused, curious eyes.
Bella, stop this right now.
My muscles locked into place, froze me where I stood. Because it wasn't Jessica's voice that rebuked me now. It was a furious voice, a familiar voice, a beautiful voice. Soft like velvet, even though it was irate. It was his voice. I was exceptionally careful not to think his name. And I was surprised that the sound of it did not knock me to my knees, did not curl me onto the pavement in a torture of loss. But there was no pain, none at all. In the instant that I heard his voice, everything was very clear, like my head had suddenly surfaced out of some dark pool. I was more aware of everything, sight, sound, the feel of the cold air that I hadn't noticed was blowing sharply against my face, the smells coming from the open bar door. I looked around myself in shock.
Go back to Jessica, the lovely voice ordered, still angry. You promised. Nothing stupid.
I was alone. Jessica stood a few feet from me, staring at me with frightened eyes. Against the wall, the strangers watched, confused, wondering what I was doing, standing there motionless in the middle of the street. I shook my head, trying to understand. I knew he wasn't there, and yet he felt improbably close. Close for the first time since the end. The anger in his voice was concern, the same anger that was once very familiar. Something I hadn't heard in what felt like a lifetime.
Keep your promise.
The voice was slipping away, as if the volume was being turned down on a radio. I began to suspect that I was having some kind of hallucination, triggered no doubt by the memory, the deja vu, the strange familiarity of the situation. I ran through the possibilities quickly in my head. Option one, I was crazy. That was the layman's term for people who heard voices in their heads. Possible. Option two, my subconscious mind was giving me what it thought I wanted. This was wish fulfillment, a momentary relief from pain by embracing the incorrect idea that he cared whether I lived or died. Projecting what he would have said if A, he were here, and B, he would be in any way bothered by something bad happening to me. Probable. I could see no option three, so I hoped it was the second option, and this was just my subconscious running amok, rather than something I would need to be hospitalized for. My reaction was hardly sane, though. I was grateful. The sound of his voice was something that I'd feared I was losing. And so more than anything else, I felt overwhelming gratitude that my unconscious mind had held on to that sound better than my conscious one had. I was not allowed to think of him. That was something I tried to be very strict about. Of course I slipped. I was only human. But I was getting better. And so the pain was something I could avoid for days at a time now. The trade-off was the never-ending numbness. Between pain and nothing, I'd chosen nothing. I waited for the pain now. I was not numb. My senses felt unusually intense after so many months of the haze. But the normal pain held off. The only ache was the disappointment that his voice was fading. There was a second of choice. The wise thing would be to run away from this potentially destructive and certainly mentally unstable development. It would be stupid to encourage hallucinations. But his voice was fading. I took another step forward, testing.
Bella, turn around, he growled.
I sighed in relief. The anger was what I wanted to hear. False, fabricated evidence that he cared. A dubious gift from my subconscious. Very few seconds had passed while I sorted this all out. My little audience watched curious. It probably looked like I was just dithering over whether or not I was going to approach them. How could they guess that I was standing there enjoying an unexpected moment of insanity?
Hi,
one of the men called, his tone both confident and a bit sarcastic. He was fair-skinned and fair-haired, and he stood with the assurance of someone who thought of himself as quite good-looking. I couldn't tell whether he was or not. I was prejudiced. The voice in my head answered with an exquisite snarl. I smiled, and the confident man seemed to take that as encouragement. "Can I help you with something? You look lost." He grinned and winked. I stepped carefully over the gutter, running with water that was black in the darkness. "No, I'm not lost." Now that I was closer and my eyes felt oddly in focus, I analyzed the short, dark man's face. It was not familiar in any way. I suffered a curious sensation of disappointment that this was not the terrible man who had tried to hurt me almost a year ago. The voice in my head was quiet now. The short man noticed my stare. "Can I buy you a drink?" he offered, nervous, seeming flattered that I'd singled him out to stare at. "I'm too young," I answered automatically. He was baffled, wondering why I had approached them. I felt compelled to explain. "From across the street, you look like someone I knew. Sorry, my mistake." The threat that had pulled me across the street had evaporated. These were not the dangerous men I remembered. They were probably nice guys. Safe. I lost interest. "That's okay," the confident blonde said. "Stay and hang out with us." "Thanks, but I can't." Jessica was hesitating in the middle of the street, her eyes wide with outrage and betrayal. "Oh, just a few minutes." I shook my head and turned to rejoin Jessica. "Let's go eat," I suggested, barely glancing at her. Though I appeared to be, for the moment, freed of the zombie abstraction, I was just as distant. My mind was preoccupied. The safe, numb deadness did not come back, and I got more anxious with every minute that passed without its return. "What were you thinking?" Jessica snapped. "You don't know them. They could have been psychopaths." I shrugged, wishing she would let it go. I just thought I knew the one guy. "You are so odd, Bella Swan. I feel like I don't know who you are." "Sorry." I didn't know what else to say to that. We walked to McDonald's in silence. I'd bet that she was wishing we'd taken her car instead of walking the short distance from the theater so that she could use the drive-thru. She was just as anxious now for this evening to be over as I had been from the beginning. I tried to start a conversation a few times while we ate, but Jessica was not cooperative. I must have really offended her. When we got back in the car, she tuned the stereo back to her favorite station and turned the volume too loud to allow easy conversation. I didn't have to struggle as hard as usual to ignore the music, even though my mind, for once, was not carefully numb and empty. I had too much to think about to hear the lyrics. I waited for the numbness to return, or the pain, because the pain must be coming. I'd broken my personal rules. Instead of shying away from the memories, I'd walked forward and greeted them. I'd heard his voice so clearly in my head. That was going to cost me. I was sure of it. Especially if I couldn't reclaim the haze to protect myself. I felt too alert, and that frightened me. But relief was still the strongest emotion in my body. Relief that came from the very core of my being. As much as I struggled not to think of him, I did not struggle to forget. I worried, late in the night, when the exhaustion of sleep deprivation broke down my defenses, that it was all slipping away, that my mind was a sieve, and I would someday not be able to remember the precise color of his eyes, the feel of his cool skin, or the texture of his voice. I could not think of them, but I must remember them. Because there was just one thing that I had to believe to be able to live. I had to know that he existed. That was all. Everything else I could endure, so long as he existed. That's why I was more trapped in Forks than I ever had been before. Why I'd fought with Charlie when he suggested a change. Honestly, it shouldn't matter. No one was ever coming back here. But if I were to go to Jacksonville or anywhere else bright and unfamiliar, How could I be sure he was real? In a place where I could never imagine him, the conviction might fade. And that I could not live through. Forbidden to remember, terrified to forget. It was a hard line to walk. I was surprised when Jessica stopped the car in front of my house. The ride had not taken long, but short as it seemed, I wouldn't have thought that Jessica could go that long without speaking. "Thanks for going out with me, Jess," I said as I opened my door. "That was fun." I hope that fun was the appropriate word. "Sure," she muttered. "I'm sorry about after the movie." "Whatever, Bella." She glared out the windshield instead of looking at me. She seemed to be growing angrier rather than getting over it. "See you Monday?" "Yeah, bye." I gave up and shut the door. She drove away, still without looking at me. I'd forgotten her by the time I was inside. Charlie was waiting for me in the middle of the hall, his arms folded tight over his chest, with his hands balled into fists. "Hey, Dad," I said absentmindedly as I ducked around Charlie, heading for the stairs. I'd been thinking about him for too long, and I wanted to be upstairs before it caught up with me. "Where have you been?" Charlie demanded. I looked at my dad, surprised. "I went to a movie in Port Angeles with Jessica, like I told you this morning." he grunted. "Is that okay?" He studied my face, his eyes widening as if he saw something unexpected. "Yeah, that's fine. Did you have fun?" "Sure," I said. "We watched zombies eat people. It was great." His eyes narrowed. "Night, Dad." He let me pass. I hurried to my room. I lay in my bed a few minutes later, resigned as the pain finally made its appearance. It was a crippling thing, this sensation that a huge hole had been punched through my chest, excising my most vital organs and leaving ragged, unhealed gashes around the edges that continued to throb and bleed despite the passage of time. Rationally, I knew my lungs must still be intact, yet I gasped for air, and my head spun like my efforts yielded me nothing. My heart must have been beating too, but I couldn't hear the sound of my pulse in my ears. My hands felt blue with cold. I curled inward, hugging my ribs to hold myself together. I scrambled for my numbness, my denial, but it evaded me. And yet I found I could survive. I was alert. I felt the pain, the aching loss that radiated out from my chest, sending racking waves of hurt through my limbs and head. But it was manageable. I could live through it. It didn't feel like the pain had weakened over time, rather that I'd grown strong enough to bear it. Whatever it was that had happened tonight, and whether it was the zombies, the adrenaline, or the hallucinations that were responsible, it had woken me up. For the first time in a long time, I didn't know what to expect in the morning. Chapter 5. Cheater. "Bella, why don't you take off?" Mike suggested, his eyes focused off to the side, not really looking at me. I wondered how long that had been going on without me noticing. It was a slow afternoon at Newton's. At the moment, there were only two patrons in the store, dedicated backpackers from the sound of their conversation. Mike had spent the last hour going through the pros and cons of two brands of lightweight packs with them, but they'd taken a break from serious pricing to indulge in trying to one-up each other with their latest tales from the trail. Their distraction had given Mike a chance to escape. "I don't mind staying," I said. I still hadn't been able to sink back into my protective shell of numbness, and everything seemed oddly close and loud today, like I'd taken cotton out of my ears. I tried to tune out the laughing hikers without success. "I'm telling you," said the thick-set man with the orange beard that didn't match his dark brown hair. "I've seen grizzlies pretty close up in Yellowstone, but they had nothing on this brute." His hair was matted, and his clothes looked like they'd been on his back for more than a few days, fresh from the mountains. Not a chance. Black bears don't get that big. The grizzlies you saw were probably cubs. The second man was tall and lean, his face tanned and wind-whipped into an impressive leathery crust. Seriously, Bella, as soon as these two give up, I'm closing the place down, Mike murmured. If you want me to go, I shrugged. On all fours, it was taller than you, the bearded man insisted, while I gathered my things together. Big as a house and pitch black. I'm going to report it to the ranger here. People ought to be warned. This wasn't up on the mountain, mind you. This was only a few miles from the trailhead. Leatherface laughed and rolled his eyes. Let me guess. You were on your way in. Hadn't eaten real food or slept off the ground in a week, right? Hey, I'm Mike, right? The bearded man called, looking toward us. See you Monday, I mumbled. Yes, sir, Mike replied, turning away. Say, have there been any warnings around here recently about black bears? No, sir. But it's always good to keep your distance and store your food correctly. Have you seen the new bear safe canisters? They only weigh 2 pounds. The door slid open to let me out into the rain. I hunched over inside my jacket as I dashed for my truck. The rain hammering against my hood sounded unusually loud, too, but soon the roar of the engine drowned out everything else. I didn't want to go back to Charlie's empty house. Last night had been particularly brutal, and I had no desire to revisit the scene of the suffering. Even after the pain had subsided enough for me to sleep, it wasn't over. Like I told Jessica after the movie, there was never any doubt that I would have nightmares. I always had nightmares now. Every night. Not nightmares, really. Not in the plural. Because it was always the same nightmare. You'd think I'd get bored after so many months, grow immune to it. But the dream never failed to horrify me. And only ended when I woke myself with screaming. Charlie didn't come in to see what was wrong anymore, to make sure there was no intruder strangling me or something like that. He was used to it now. My nightmare probably wouldn't even frighten someone else. Nothing jumped out and screamed boo. There were no zombies, no ghosts, no psychopaths. There was nothing, really. Only nothing. Just the endless maze of moss-covered trees. So quiet that the silence was an uncomfortable pressure against my eardrums. It was dark, like dusk on a cloudy day, with only enough light to see that there was nothing to see. I hurried through the gloom without a path, always searching, 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 getting more frantic as the time stretched on, trying to move faster, though the speed made me clumsy. Then there would come the point in my dream, and I could feel it coming now, but could never seem to wake myself up before it hit. When I couldn't remember what it was that I was searching for. When I realized that there was nothing to search for, and nothing to find. That there never had been anything more than just this empty, dreary wood. And there never would be anything more for me. Nothing but nothing. That was usually about when the screaming started. I wasn't paying attention to where I was driving, just wandering through empty, wet side roads as I avoided the ways that would take me home, because I didn't have anywhere to go. I wished I could feel numb again, but I couldn't remember how I'd managed it before. The nightmare was nagging at my mind and making me think about things that would cause me pain. I didn't want to remember the forest. Even as I shuddered away from the images, I felt my eyes fill with tears and the aching begin around the edges of the hole in my chest. I took one hand from the steering wheel and wrapped it around my torso to hold it in one piece. It will be as if I'd never existed. The words ran through my head, lacking the perfect clarity of my hallucination last night. They were just words, soundless, like print on a page. Just words. But they ripped the hole wide open, and I stomped on the brake, knowing I should not drive while this incapacitated. I curled over, pressing my face against the steering wheel and trying to breathe without lungs. I wondered how long this could last. Maybe someday, years from now. If the pain would just decrease to the point where I could bear it, I would be able to look back on those few short months that would always be the best of my life. And if it were possible that the pain would ever soften enough to allow me to do that, I was sure that I would feel grateful for as much time as he'd given me. More than I'd asked for. More than I deserved. Maybe someday I'd be able to see it that way. But what if this hole never got any better? If the raw edges never healed? If the damage was permanent and irreversible? I held myself tightly together. As if he'd never existed, I thought in despair. What a stupid and impossible promise to make. He could steal my pictures and reclaim his gifts, but that didn't put things back the way they'd been before I'd met him. The physical evidence was the most insignificant part of the equation. I was changed. My insides altered almost past the point of recognition. Even my outsides looked different. My face sallow, white except for the purple circles the nightmares had left under my eyes. My eyes were dark enough against my pallid skin that, if I were beautiful and seen from a distance, I might even pass for a vampire now. But I was not beautiful, and I probably looked closer to a zombie. As if he'd never existed? That was insanity. It was a promise that he could never keep. A promise that was broken as soon as he'd made it. I thumped my head against the steering wheel, trying to distract myself from the sharper pain. It made me feel silly for ever worrying about keeping my promise. Where was the logic in sticking to an agreement that had already been violated by the other party? Who cared if I was reckless and stupid? There was no reason to avoid recklessness. No reason why I shouldn't get to be stupid. I laughed humorlessly to myself, still gasping for air. Reckless and forks. Now there was a hopeless proposition. The dark humor distracted me, and the distraction eased the pain. My breath came easier, and I was able to lean back against the seat. Though it was cold today, my forehead was damp with sweat. I concentrated on my hopeless proposition to keep from sliding back into the excruciating memories. To be reckless in forks would take a lot of creativity, maybe more than I had. But I wished I could find some way. I might feel better if I weren't holding fast all alone to a broken pact. If I were an oathbreaker too. But how could I cheat on my side of the deal, here in this harmless little town? Of course, Forks hadn't always been so harmless, but now it was exactly what it had always appeared to be. It was dull. It was safe. I stared out the windshield for a long moment, my thoughts moving sluggishly. I couldn't seem to make those thoughts go anywhere. I cut the engine, which was groaning in a pitiful way after idling for so long, and stepped out into the drizzle. The cold rain dripped through my hair and then trickled across my cheeks like freshwater tears. It helped to clear my head. I blinked the water from my eyes, staring blankly across the road. After a minute of staring, I recognized where I was. I'd parked in the middle of the north lane of Russell Avenue. I was standing in front of the Cheney's house. My truck was blocking their driveway, and across the road lived the Marxes. I knew I needed to move my truck, and that I ought to go home. It was wrong to wander the way I had, distracted and impaired, a menace on the roads of Forks. Besides, someone would notice me soon enough and report me to Charlie. As I took a deep breath in preparation to move, a sign in the Marx's yard caught my eye. It was just a big piece of cardboard leaning against their mailbox post, with black letters scrawled in caps across it. Sometimes kismet happens. Coincidence? Or was it meant to be? I didn't know, but it seemed kind of silly to think that it was somehow fated. That the dilapidated motorcycles rusting in the Marx's front yard, beside the hand-printed "For Sale, As Is" sign, was serving some higher purpose by existing there, right where I needed them to be. So maybe it wasn't kismet. Maybe there were just all kinds of ways to be reckless. And I only now had my eyes open to them. Reckless and stupid. Those were Charlie's two very favorite words to apply to motorcycles. Charlie's job didn't get a lot of action compared to cops in bigger towns, but he did get called in on traffic accidents. With the long, wet stretches of freeway twisting and turning through the forest, blind corner after blind corner, there was no shortage of that kind of action. But even with all the huge log haulers barreling around the turns, mostly people walked away. The exceptions to that rule were often on motorcycles, and Charlie had seen one too many victims, almost always kids, smeared on the highway. He'd made me promise before I was 10 that I would never accept a ride on a motorcycle. Even at that age, I didn't have to think twice before promising. Who would want to ride a motorcycle here? It would be like taking a 60-mile-per-hour bath. So many promises I kept. It clicked together for me then. I wanted to be stupid and reckless. And I wanted to break promises. Why stop at one? That's as far as I thought it through. I sloshed through the rain to the Marks' front door and rang the bell. One of the Marks boys opened the door. The younger one, the freshman. Couldn't remember his name. His sandy hair only came up to my shoulder. He had no trouble remembering my name. Bella Swan? He asked in surprise. How much do you want for the bike? I panted, jerking my thumb over my shoulder toward the sales display. Are you serious? He demanded. Of course I am. They don't work. I sighed impatiently. This was something I'd already inferred from the sign. How much? If you really want one, just take it. My mom made my dad move them down to the road so they'd get picked up with the garbage. I glanced at the bikes again and saw that they were resting on a pile of yard clippings and dead branches. Are you positive about that? Sure. You want to ask her? It was probably better not to involve adults who might mention this to Charlie. No, I believe you. You want me to help you? He offered. They're not light. Okay, thanks. I only need one, though. Might as well take both, the boy said. Maybe you could scavenge some parts. He followed me out into the downpour and helped me load both of the heavy bikes into the back of my truck. He seemed eager to be rid of them, so I didn't argue. What are you going to do with them anyway? He asked. They haven't worked in years. I kind of guessed that, I said, shrugging. My spur-of-the-moment whim hadn't come with a plan intact. Maybe I'll take them to Dowling's, he snorted. Dowling would charge more to fix them than they'd be worth running. I couldn't argue with that. John Dowling had earned a reputation for his pricing. No one went to him except in an emergency. Most people preferred to make the drive up to Port Angeles if their car was able. I'd been very lucky on that front. I'd been worried, when Charlie first gifted me my ancient truck, that I wouldn't be able to afford to keep it running. But I'd never had a single problem with it, other than the screaming loud engine and the 55-mile-per-hour maximum speed limit. Jacob Black had kept it in great shape when it had belonged to his father, Billy. Inspiration hit like a bolt of lightning. Not unreasonable considering the storm. You know what? That's okay. I know someone who builds cars. Oh, that's good, he smiled in relief. He waved as I pulled away, still smiling. Friendly kid. I drove quickly and purposefully now, in a hurry to get home before there was the slightest chance of Charlie appearing, even in the highly unlikely event that he might knock off early. I dashed through the house to the phone, keys still in hand. Chief Swan, please, I said when the deputy answered. It's Bella. Oh, hey, Bella, Deputy Steve said affably.